Good morning again. Second case this morning is United States versus Perkins. This is a certified case, but it's an unusual certified case in that it's certified for the side that doesn't usually get certified. So, is counsel for the appellant ready? The government. So, we will argue in the normal order, counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Bill Garrity, and I represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant Calvin Perkins, United States Marine Corps. Chief Judge Stuckey, the appellant respectfully requests 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
This court can find in favor of the appellant in four different ways, each resolving the case through a successively wider legal aperture. First, since the specific facts of this case establish circumstances addressed directly in Leon, where suppression remains appropriate, the good faith exception is not available to the government under either Hoffman or Carter. Second, because the record fails to show the base commander had a substantial basis to determine there was probable cause to search appellant's home, this court can simply apply the plain language of MRE 311 as it did in Hoffman. Third, this court can narrowly overrule Carter as an unwarranted departure from the plain language of MRE 311. And finally, this court can more broadly overrule Carter by addressing the issues of neutrality, detachment, deference, and deterrence raised by the application of the military good faith exception to searches authorized by a commander. Turning first to the most narrow way that this court could find in favor of appellant, in this case, under the specific facts, the commander's affidavit sets forth a prima facie case that he rubber-stamped Special Agent Jay's request for a command-authorized search. The other evidence that the government chose to present at trial does not overcome that prima facie case that the commander rubber-stamped the affidavit. It's not much of a summary to say for the affidavit to characterize it this way. Agent Jay informed me that MI had reported earlier that day that Sergeant Perkins was extorting her by threatening to reveal personal nude photos and photographs if she did not purchase him goods. Agent J informed me that the videos and pictures were likely contained inside Sergeant Perkins' home, and due to an earlier conversation with Sergeant Major O, she believed Sergeant Perkins was returning home that evening. I determined there was probable cause. That affidavit outlines no independent rational process that the commander utilized in determining a substantial basis existed for probable cause to search appellant's home. By rubber stamping the search authorization, the CO failed to perform his neutral and detached function as is required by Gates and Leon. The burden is on the government to show that the search is not unlawful.
Well, you have an allegation of extortion. You know, let's leave aside what they found when they got in there. You got an allegation of extortion backed up by an admission of hanky-panky by the alleging person with the appellant, and which contains, one, an allegation that he used the phone during sex, which is kind of, I don't know, demeaning, but leave that aside. But two, that he, in fact, shook her down for some expensive items like a gun safe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How is that not enough?
Your Honor, it may be enough to establish probable cause that extortion is afoot. But the issue here is not that in establishing probable cause to believe extortion occurred, it's that special agents were seeking to search inside appellant's home. There was no evidence or no substantial
if what she said, which was that he threatened to release compromising photos of her, if she wouldn't buy him a gun safe and all this other stuff, which she then went ahead and did.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is the allegation that he made the threat and that it included photos and other things kept, you know, the in today's world are often electronic media. Why isn't that enough?
Well, Your Honor, what you may have there is a hypothetical nexus between the offense and photographs. There, no one had seen the photographs. It is true that she alleges that he had his
No one's seen the photographs because nobody's looked for them. But that's not my point. My point is, how much more would you need if the focus of the search, now again, leaving aside what they actually found, if the focus of the search was for compromising photographs of MI and the appellant in compromising positions, what more do you need?
Your Honor, you may have a reason and a reasonable basis to go looking for the photographs. No one had seen them. The only evidence...
If you have a reasonable basis, isn't that enough?
The special agent is the one who provides the possibility that he used the phone. MI didn't testify that to that. The special agent testified that since she said she remembers him using the phone in bed, he may have used his phone.
Well, but what she did testify to was substantially more damaging, i.e. that he extorted her with the threat of photographs, of making photographs public. To me, that's a lot more heavy duty than waving the phone around during a sexual act.
Yes,
but anyway, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, but the idea is, does that give license to go into the most protected place? So if a mere allegation of a crime, and even if you have established the probable cause might exist that the crime is occurring, that doesn't create a nexus between that crime, the specific evidence that you're looking for, and the specific place that you're looking for.
Okay, so your point is not that there might not have been probable cause, but that there wasn't probable cause to search the house?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
They may have had probable cause to search even his phone, and that's arguable even on that basis, but that's the one item that we knew wasn't in Sergeant Perkins' house.
No, because he was TDY.
Yes, okay. Your Honor. And the issue that Your Honor raises is central to the resolution of many of the issues in this case, and that is, what is the actual evidence that was before the commander at the time? What we have is we have the CO's affidavit where he describes what he considered. We have Special Agent George's very spotty recollection of what she told them. And the government also is using results of investigation reports that weren't even prepared at the time. And so there is no reliable way to determine what specific facts the special agent told the commander. There's simply no record that can be reliably examined to determine whether there was a substantial basis for the CO to determine probable cause to search appellant's home for electronic media storage devices that might be located in his home.
So is your better argument then that the problem is with the commander rubber stamping, or is your better argument that the problem was with Special Agent JJ and what she knew she had not told the commander, the evidence that she did not have here?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the third of the special circumstances outlined in Leon. We believe, as a prefatory matter, the CO's rubber stamping is dispositive of the case. The fact that the remaining evidence that the government presented at the motion session doesn't overcome that means this court can dispose of it on the basis of rubber stamping. It is certainly true, as the judge in dissent below found, that one could reach a conclusion that the good faith exception doesn't apply because of the information that it's not clear that the special agent told the commander in asking to authorize the search. But whether it is the rubber stamping, whether it is the complete lack of a factual nexus, which implicates the facial unreliability of what the agent told the CO, if there's no concrete nexus, it would fail under that portion of Leon as well. But
so I'm just trying to get at, though, is the better argument that we should view this through the eyes of a commanding officer who's not a lawyer, or through the eyes of a trained investigator who knows what evidence she had, or more importantly, what evidence she did not have in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or are you saying both are equally as well, or as advantageous to your position? Or are you saying you think the rubber stamping one is the better argument?
I think that the rubber stamping one is the better one, Your Honor. However, what Special Agent George knew or didn't know, or the perspective, may factor in not for the under both Carter and Hoffman, but the issue of what she reasonably believed at the time she was seeking the authorization, and for what reason she relied on the authorization. That becomes important in that determination. But on the prefatory matter, where this court can decide most narrowly, is any one of those three circumstances described in Leon would be sufficient. There was, even if you could get over the hurdle, as the lower court could not, that it was not so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to be unreasonable, the fact remains there still isn't a substantial basis for probable cause, and that is, if that is true, then under the plain language, yes, Your Honor.
Oh, please finish your sentence.
If that is true, then under the plain language of 311C, the good faith exception would not be available to the government in that case as well.
Counsel, the government emphasizes that Special Agent JJ consulted with JAG and that the commander knew of this. Is that relevant in terms of whether this is rubber stamping?
Your Honor, I don't know if even if her consultation with the judge advocates overcomes the commander's rubber stamp. There's no evidence that the commander consulted with those attorneys. What we have is, in response to more information that the CO requested, she said, "I consulted with Judge Advocates." There's nothing in the record that clearly indicates what she told him about those conversations with the Judge Advocates. That might matter if we knew that they had explained to her that there was a substantial basis for probable cause and she told the CO that. But all we have from this record is a very ambiguous statement as to whether she consulted them about the need for a verbal authorization as opposed to a written affidavit or those things. She just said she consulted with Judge Advocate.
Well, doesn't that actually help your case? I mean, here you have the commanding officer saying, "I want more evidence. I want more information." And what she says is essentially two things. Number one, don't worry your pretty little head about it. We've had three JAs, two of whom are trial counsel and one is the SJA. So essentially she's saying, hey, we've figured this out. I've talked to three prosecutors who know what they're doing. Don't worry about it. And then, secondly, she raises the bloody flag. She says, you need to be focused on what effect this crime might have on the command. So doesn't that, in fact, help your case when it comes to rubber stamping?
Yes, sir. I think it absolutely does. Because, again, it indicates that the CO did not make an independent determination, a neutral and detached determination about probable cause. The fact that Special Agent Jay made inferences, that's all well and good. But Gates tells us that the fundamental protection of the Fourth Amendment is that the authorizing official makes that. And so if in response to, I told him all the facts. Did he have a response? He asked me for the facts. So I told him the facts again, and I told him those two things. That doesn't advance the ball for telling us that the commander made a neutral and detached determination and performed it at a perfunctory level.
Counsel, could you just give some more suggestions as to what the commander should have done in this case?
I mean,
he could have denied it, said it's insufficient, but if he had wanted more information, what should he have done?
The commander should have asked, well, We don't know what the commander did or didn't ask or consider because the record is deficient in that way. But had this gone the way that it should have, the commander should have asked the special agent to explain specifically why she believed whatever she was looking for was in that. What basis did she have other than it's possible that that could happen? If we had a record, as would be required in a telephonic warrant under the federal rules, you would have a record of what they considered and what they talked about. The real problem here is that we don't have that, and the military rules necessarily allow for that. It has to work that way for our rules to work where they need to work and when they need to work. But the fact that there's a deficiency as a result of that, the burden is on the government to demonstrate what should have happened here, or that there is sufficient evidence to make out a case for a substantial basis for probable cause. I see that my time is limited, and in terms of one of the issues certified here is whether Hoffman or Carter controls. Again, this court can very narrowly overturn Carter simply on the basis that stare decisis requires it to be poorly reasoned. I don't think it's completely unreasonable, but the methodology which it uses to accomplish its objective is unsound. To read in language that isn't there, to have substantial basis mean different things in different places, I'm not sure what substantial basis means in a given situation. I went back to Gates, and what Gates says is, when mentioned substantial basis, it's referencing Johnson, which was a case that involved could hearsay be a substantial basis.
And Counsel, may I just ask on this point, is it really necessary to choose between Carter and Hoffman? I mean, couldn't they both coexist such that we would conclude that the good faith exception applies if either the magistrate or commanding officer believes or has a substantial basis, or the person executing the warrant believes that the person had a substantial basis? I mean, is it really necessary to overrule the precedent, or could we just live with both Carter and Hoffman?
Your Honor, the difficulty is in the application. There needs to be clear guidance from which perspective. Your Honor, I see that my time is about to expire.
Please answer the question.
So this goes to the fourth way in which this court can resolve this case more broadly. If this court is going to live in a world where Carter and Hoffman coexist, there has to be some resolution of those things. And I think that the core issue here is, how do those concepts of neutrality, detachment, deference, and deterrence interact? You know, Carter points to the drafter's analysis as a reason for needing to exist, but you can't take a part of the drafter's analysis and ignore the other parts, which seem to indicate that a commander's search authorization is different. And that may very well be the distinction between Carter and the plain language application, is that a commander search authorization is different and must be considered in a different way than a neutral and detached magistrate. The drafter's analysis says in a pre-Twitter universe, in all caps, magistrates may be empowered to issue search authorizations. There is no other place in the drafter's analysis other than titles where they say something in all caps. And that may be a resolution of this case, is to encourage. I mean, it's not the position of the legal system to dictate that, but it may be that it's necessary to create a situation where that is encouraged. And that can resolve the question of, is a commander search different, or should it be treated differently than someone who is a more neutral and detached magistrate?
Chief, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
So let's assume for a moment that Carter and Hoffman are irreconcilable. What principles under our any court's typical stare decisis doctrine, what principles are you looking at specifically that says that we can ignore Carter after almost 20 years of it being on the books, and after it's been cited favorably, and after there have been changes to that by Congress, and yet nothing has changed Carter? What are you looking at that says that this court can ignore the principle of stare decisis? Or, to state it a little bit more accurately, what principles are we looking at to say that the principle of stare decisis is surmounted for a specific reason?
Yes, Your Honor. And first, again, looking at this court has said on any number of occasions that the plain language of a rule should apply unless there's a reason it shouldn't, essentially that it would lead to an absurd result. Carter's fundamental premise that this rule, the plain language, leads to an absurd result is flawed. It says it reads out the good faith exception. It doesn't in its entirety. If you focus only on the probable cause section of
okay, but Shepherd, my concern would be if any later court looks at an opinion and says, well, the decision was flawed, why is that not completely dispensing of the principle of stare decisis?
In walking through the, and perhaps appellant did it inartfully in the brief, that's the starting point. The second point is, you know, what is the reasonable reliance of service members on that? There is a great deal of confusion in the cases involving search and seizure. The terms commander, magistrate, they're used interchangeably. And so there is a very good reason to clarify it, as is in the drafter's analysis, you know, for 311, you know, is a commander search authorization different? If Carter and Hoffman are irreconcilable, then the need would be to be able to evaluate a commander search authorization under the terms it needs to be authorized. Even the term commander, Your Honor, is misleading. Carter, is it 1992? The world looked vastly different in 2001, in March of 2001 when that case was decided. The rules contemplate that command could devolve to a staff NCO or an NCO all the way down. And so the drafter's analysis indicates that you have to view that determination differently than you would someone who holds a judicial office or who is trained in the law. And that makes sense. But under Carter's rubric, because of the huge amount of deference that's given to a magistrate's determination, you can't get at those things which are necessary. And the case United States v. Stuckey outlines that and outlines it contains a very good discussion. And that discussion, Your Honor, was continued by this court's predecessor in Lopez. And Lopez, it's an opinion and three concurrences which outline most of the issues that are discussed or that are necessary for analysis in this case about the source of a commander's power, how it applies, where it would apply. There's been a great focus on footnote 5 in this court's opinion in Nieto, but it's also important to look at footnote 4, which is how do these rules apply in every clime and place? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Kurt Siegel, and along with Colonel Mark Jameson, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the military judge's ruling below for two reasons. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding there was probable cause to search Appellant's home. And second, even if there was not probable cause, Carter's good faith exception applies here. And I'd like to first discuss probable cause before I turn to the choice of authorities issue for the good faith exception. So as to probable cause, the complaining witness reported that Appellant had taken photos of her while they engaged in sexual activity, that he was threatening to release those photos, that during sexual activity he may have taken or he used his cell phone, that he may have used other devices while they engaged in sexual activity, and that he had electronic devices in his home that could store this media.
Counsel, was there any corroboration of those assertions by the civilian who walked in off the street?
No, Your Honor, there was no
question. Was there any determination of her credibility?
The record is not clear on that, Your Honor. But we would cite United States versus Leedy for the proposition that no corroboration is necessary.
Well, she said, well, he could have taken other pictures with other stuff. The one thing she had was that he waved a camera around while they were having sex, right?
A cell phone, yes, Your Honor.
Right, a cell phone camera. Cell phone around while they were having sex.
That's correct, Your
Honor. The rest was supposition, right?
Yes.
Not the presence of electronic devices in the house, but the notion that he could have used something else to take some other pictures. Now, cutting the other way is the fact that he threatened her, or she alleged that he threatened her with exposing pictures, with embarrassing stuff if she didn't buy him all this merchandise. So where does that leave us?
Well, Your Honor, we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below. And looking at Special Agent JJ's testimony, it's clear that appellant threatened to release these photos or videos that he had taken.
Well, that he allegedly had taken.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I suppose he could have been an out-and-out liar to her, but he did threaten.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay.
And that we knew that there were devices in his home that could store that media. We knew that this was an in-person report from someone who knew the appellant, which made this drastically different from Nieto, where there were strangers who met that appellant in a public location. There are more reasonable inferences that can be drawn from someone who knows the appellant.
Now, you said we know that there were devices in the house that could store the media.
Yes, Your Honor.
In that regard, we're not talking about mainframe computers or something that is some technological wizardry. A simple laptop could store the medium, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And so what percentage of our service members have laptops?
Your Honor, I couldn't speculate on that.
Would you pretend to speculate for a moment here? I mean, would you think that it would be a very high percentage of our service members who have laptops? So
yes, Your Honor,
we're not talking about anything special when we're talking about something that could store this medium. Could be as simple as a laptop.
Yes, Your Honor, it could be. However, unlike in Nieto, where all we knew was there was a laptop, we know that appellant, in fact, owned other devices.
So how are you getting this nexus between the particularized nexus referred to in Nieto, between a cell phone that may or may not have had an SD card, a cell phone that all the evidence indicates was in the possession of the accused at the time rather than his home? How are you then tying it into the house where you would not be tying it into every service member's home if a crime has been alleged by a person off the street with no corroboration, no investigation of their credibility, who says that one of our service members has engaged in a criminal offense with a cell phone? How does that not ineluctably lead to tearing apart someone's house? Because it might be a little bitty SD card somewhere stuck in that house.
Yes, Your Honor. So we would cite to this court's decision in Epps and the reasonable inferences that can be drawn. There was also testimony that the appellant didn't want a paper trail, so he was a savvy individual. And there are reasonable inferences that can be drawn from that. We knew that there was a cell phone, and we knew positively that there were other devices. And we believe that it's a reasonable inference and that the commander could have drawn a reasonable inference between the two devices.
Okay. So how does that then not lead us to conclude? Or let me put it this way. How would we draft an opinion, this court, that would not open the floodgates to say, if someone makes an allegation against a serviceman that involves a cell phone, you have the green light from us to go and tear apart that service member's home?
Well, Your Honor, ultimately it's going to be the magistrate's determination under the totality of the circumstances. So there are factors here that I think would distinguish it from a standard someone comes in off the street. He knew that this woman knew the appellant, that she had had a history with him. We knew that he had used the phone in bed with her. We knew that she had been in his home by virtue of claiming that he had these devices. So given those facts, we believe that this is drastically different from something like a Nieto or even a Smith, where there's a public interaction between personnel out in the commissary or in the latrine, that relationship allows for certain reasonable inferences to be drawn just under the totality of the circumstances.
So, to beat a dead horse,
yes,
if we've got, isn't this kind of the mirror image of revenge porn, where you now could have a situation where a spurned lover can come forward to CO and say, he attempted or she attempted to blackmail me, and I was in that person's home, the accused's home. I can tell you that they had a laptop, which is a storage device. And so, again, what is stopping us from having a disgruntled former lover result in a service member's home being ripped apart because we're saying to magistrates in the future that this court is giving the rubber stamp to say you can look for an SD card because it could have been an SD card on that cell phone that has stored these images?
Your Honor, we would again cite to United States versus Leedy. In that case, the appellant's roommate reported to Air Force Office of Special Investigations that he had seen a file title alone entitled 14-year-old Filipino girl. There was no corroboration in that case and no attempt at corroboration. And yet this court found that that was sufficient probable cause to authorize a search. We believe that this is a similar scenario, that there is an element of corroboration and that there is an element of veracity that comes into play. Leedy is also very instructive on that, says that that is a factor to consider also under Gates. But that is something to consider under the totality of the circumstances, and I don't think that that necessarily opens up a green light for anyone to take a claim at face value. There is an element of veracity that comes into play. But even if this court doesn't believe that probable cause exists, we believe that Carter's good faith exception.
Before you move on, Lieutenant,
yes,
Siegel, I disagree with Judge Olson's contention that this horse is dead. I want to take another swipe at it here. And my question is this. Isn't some of the problem here that there's some speculating going on the part of the reporting witness and some speculating going on with your part of the on the part of the investigator as the information is related to the commander? Is that a characterization you agree or disagree with? And you can do either. My feelings won't be hurt. You know what I'm saying? Is there...
Beg your pardon.
Let me say it again.
Yes, sir.
All right. Is some of the problem here that there's too much speculation on the part of the reporting witness, as well as speculation on the part of the investigator as the information is reported to the commander, the search authority? Is that some of the problem here, or have I mischaracterized it, or do you agree or disagree with my characterization of that?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree slightly with that characterization. The complaining witness here came forward and affirmatively stated that the appellant was threatening to release something. There's no speculation involved there. He had claimed to own these photos. And then as to what the agent relayed to the commander, on Joint Appendix 73, she states that she relayed all the facts that she knew at the time, which is everything that the complaining witness had reported, which is the fact that the complaining witness had gone to another commander, had been so afraid of this that she'd sought an MPO and received one. And then following that, the appellant called her and told her that he was aware she'd reported this law enforcement. He'd previously told her that she would face consequences for reporting it. There's not speculation involved in that, Your Honor. There are facts to back that up.
I understand. Thank you.
Counsel.
Sir.
If we simply say that there are probable cause, then we don't have to get into good faith, and then we don't have to get into picking between these two cases, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I also don't think that you need to pick between the two cases regardless of which decision you come to. We agree with all the counsel here that they're reconcilable.
Okay.
Turning to the choice of the...
Can you articulate how they're reconcilable? I know that Judge Maggs has addressed that. From the government's viewpoint, how are they reconcilable?
Yes, Your Honor. So this court's opinion in Hoffman was not explicit on how it was applying the good faith exception, other than articulating the text of the rule. But we believe that looking to the facts of that case and its reference back to the probable cause section, it could fall into at least two of the four exceptions to Carter. Specifically, it could fall into the false reckless affidavit category. If you look at footnote 3 of the Hoffman opinion, it could also fall under the facially deficient affidavit section, which would tie it in line with Nieto. We believe that when there's zero nexus whatsoever between an appellant and other evidence in the case where there's purely an intuitive relationship, that could, and this court could have been saying, that falls within the facially deficient affidavit category, which would actually reconcile it with Carter. So we don't believe that either case needs to be overturned. We believe that they are fully reconcilable. And to turn to the stare decisis elements, we believe that this court decided this issue 18 years ago in United States versus Carter. That opinion was lengthy in its analysis of the good faith exception, and the president has not changed the text of the good faith exception since that time. We don't believe there are any intervening events that require this court to overturn that decision. And to the extent that members of the court disagree with Carter or its analysis, we would hold that stare decisis' entire point is to require that the court uphold decisions it may later disagree with. So we believe that stare decisis applies in this case to uphold Carter. We believe that Carter is workable. It absolves the absurd result of reading out the good faith exception. We believe that intervening events show that the president is intending and has intended to model Supreme Court case law. The appellant's proffered special justification, which was only raised in his reply brief. We haven't responded to that in writing, and if this court were to find that was persuasive, we would ask to submit matters on that. But the appellant's justification is that there is a distinction between commanders and magistrates or judges. We believe that's not relevant to this determination. The text of the rule under 315D1 requires that a commander be impartial. If he is not, it's an invalid search warrant or search authorization. And 311C3 alpha requires that he meet 315D. So the good faith exception is not being, we're not asking to apply it to anybody who's not neutral and detached. We believe that Carter fully states the law and that there is nothing that has changed it.
Counsel, could you respond to appellant's argument that the commander rubber stamped, or more specifically, that there's nothing in the record that would allow us to determine whether the commander rubber stamped or didn't rubber stamp this request for a search authorization?
Certainly, Your Honor. So, again, the evidence presented a nexus to the appellant's home, and the commander at Joint Appendix 117 in his affidavit states that I determined there was probable cause to search, to issue a search authorization and search appellant's home. That was unchallenged. Appellant never raised the idea that this was a rubber stamp at trial. So to the extent he raises that now, we believe that that's waived.
In what context are the words rubber stamped ordinarily used in this area of the law? So when they're talking about a magistrate rubber stamping a search, what do they mean?
Your Honor, I haven't done extensive case law research into the rubber stamp aspect. What it seems to indicate is when there is no analysis done on the part of the magistrate or the commander. We believe that there was analysis done in this case. He says that he determined that there was probable cause. We believe he had sufficient information presented to him. And we believe that that is viewed in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. There is nothing to challenge the fact that the commander stated, I determined there was probable cause.
What's your position on the following, that he asked for more information from Special Agent JJ, and as we discussed earlier, there doesn't seem to have been any additional information other than three JAGs have already looked at it, and, hey, Commander, you should be concerned about the effect that this type of crime would have on our units. Why shouldn't that give us pause? If he's asking for more evidence, and he doesn't seem to be getting any.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that that just shows that the commander was interested and engaged in the conversation, that he was actually asking questions. The fact that he didn't receive anything, that this court may view it as moving the needle either way, doesn't detract from the fact that he had sufficient information before him to determine that there was probable cause to search the home. So we don't think that that actually is the analysis. As to the rubber stamp, we would again go back to what the commander stated. I determined there was probable cause, and that was unchallenged. As to the application of Carter in this case, we again state that appellant has waived his challenge that the commander was neutral and detached. That was not. We would also state that Special Agent JJ reasonably relied on the issuance of this search authorization. She had spoken with a complaining witness who presented her with sufficient facts, that she then, upon receiving that information, consulted with multiple judge advocates and received information that she had probable cause to search the home. And then following that, she spoke with the commander, who also determined there was probable cause. We believe that...
Whose duty is it to determine probable cause?
Your Honor, it's the commander's or the magistrate's.
So even if he's wrong, how does that interplay with her ability to rely on the warrant?
Your Honor, if he's wrong in determining that there was probable cause, we believe that you would look at what an objectively reasonable officer would think, looking at all of the information that was presented and how the process went through.
So in that light, we could consider her discussions with the attorneys?
Well, Your Honor, you could consider the discussions with the attorneys based on the fact that she told them all of the same information. That's on Joint Appendix 73. She says, I told them all the facts I knew. They told me there was probable cause. I then told the commander all the facts I knew. He also determined probable cause. But we also believe it comes into play under 311C3 Charlie, which requires that she reasonably seek and rely on the issuance of it. We believe that her actions in seeking out attorney approval, it shows the clearest indication that she was acting in reasonable good faith. That's from Messerschmidt v. Melender, which is a qualified immunity case, but states that the standards are the same. We also believe that she showed her reliance on that search authorization when she went to appellant's home, found evidence that was not explicitly listed in her authorization, and then stopped what she was doing, called the commander, and sought an additional search authorization, which she received. We believe that Carter's application here is clear and concise, which is exactly what the CCA found below. It took them not long to apply Carter. They found it very workable. And, Your Honor, I see I'm nearly out of time, barring any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Addressing the government's contention that there's a factual basis to determine probable cause, proffers aren't evidence, and what the government is asking this court to do is not apply the good faith, but blind faith. There's no evidence that the commander knew about the SD card or the agent's speculations about it. There's not even evidence of that. That whole dialogue was between the lawyers in the Article 39A session. When asked, why did you ask for a search broader than just the cell phone? I believe it's at Joint Appendix 75. That's when the agent said, because of this. What no one asked the agent was, did you tell the commander that that's why you wanted to search for that? The fact that the lawyers discussed it in the 39A or it was important to them, that's not who was making the probable cause determination. Secondarily, there's no evidence. Again, the mistake that the military judge makes is it may make him more convinced of MI's reliability that she was recorded, but there is no nexus, nothing connecting that videotaping to the commander. It's the deficiency of the record, and that's the obligation of the government in this case, to provide sufficient information for them to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the command that the search was not unlawful. A conclusory statement by the commander that he determined probable cause based on the agent's conclusory statement, that should not suffice.
At trial, did the defense raise the issue that the person issuing the warrant was not a neutral, detached magistrate?
Your Honor, that is a question of neutrality and detachment versus impartiality. The government cited the fact that it requires an impartial detachment. Our position in this is that neutrality and detachment is a greater concept than just bias. This court's decision in Hunsaker is an example of you could find that the commander is disqualified because of bias. There's nothing to indicate that he was biased or unbiased.
Was there anything to indicate that the agents in this case acted in bad faith?
Your Honor, the dissenting judge below seemed to indicate that he would find that there was. Again, there's no affirmative evidence. I think you get to that by the lack of evidence in this case. The fact that even assuming that Special Agent George, who can't remember what she specifically told the CO, says, well, you know, what she's talking about is uncorroborated or speculative, there's no evidence she told the CO that. That would deprive the CO of the ability to make the required neutral and detached determination under Gates. I see my time has expired, Chief Judge.
Do you have any further answer for Judge Orion, or have you completed it?
Sure.
So you've got Special Agent JJ. Presumably she hasn't gone to law school and gone through all this either. She goes to a magistrate. He says, good to go. She talks to three separate JAGs, and they say probable cause. So why wouldn't that be a perfect picture of the good faith exception? She honestly believed that all these three lawyers and the commander say there's probable cause. What am I supposed to do? Not now execute this?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's for two reasons in this particular case. One, there is such a lack of a factual nexus as really for it to be unreasonable for the agent to believe.
That goes back to my question, counsel, about whose job is it to determine, make the probable cause determination. Is it the agent's, or is it the person that issues the search authorization? And I think, and I doubt we'll disagree, that it's the latter, not the former.
I'm sorry, I was a bit confused by the question, Your Honor. I apologize.
I had asked a question in either of you or of the government earlier about whose job is it to make the probable cause determination, and the answer that I was given is it's the magistrate or the commanding officer. Do you disagree with that answer?
Your Honor, it's the job of the agent to provide evidence that makes out a substantial basis, and then it is the Gates requires that determination be made by a neutral and detached magistrate. It is, I think Gates says, it's the core of the Fourth Amendment's protections, is that not that the inferences aren't available to a law enforcement agent, but that those inferences be made by a neutral and detached authority. And so to go back to your question, Your Honor, is that in failing to provide that information, the commander, by definition, cannot make that neutral and detached determination. It isn't a factor of whether he's biased or not biased. There's one form that takes away neutrality and detachment. And again, I go back to the discussion that this court's predecessor had in Lopez. I think it was Judge Sullivan's concurrence discussed the issue of the difference between impartiality and neutrality and detachment. And Judge Wiss's concurrence said, a commander's not ineligible per se, but he's not entitled to the same deference unless the government shows that he should be or she should be entitled to that deference. So, again, the burden is on the government here, and in this case, the record doesn't give this court enough to support the finding that the commander had a substantial basis for probable cause.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court will be in recess until 11:50.
The court stands in recess until 11:50.